Richard M. Cohen struggles with failing limbs and is legally blind due to his diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. He survived two bouts of colon cancer and a life-threatening blood clot in his lungs. After enduring decades of harsh treatments and invasive therapies, Cohen decided to trade his life as a patient. Cohen chronicles his journey with humor, self-deprecation, and incredible insight in his new memoir, Chasing Hope, A Patient's Deep Dive into Stem Cells, Faith, and the Future. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you so much.
What do you mean by trading in your life as a patient?
Well, for decades, I went through very traditional treatments for the MS in particular. And, you know, MS is a disease that for years had no treatments. They slowly developed a couple, and it was not very remarkable. And I just decided that I didn't want to do it anymore, you know, that it was time to try something new. And I was very lucky. Meredith and I, my wife and I, had been to a stem cell conference at the Vatican. I got into a stem cell clinical trial for MS, and everything changed because I realized that cell therapy was going to take over medicine, and it's a very exciting technology, and at last, I felt like I was doing something.
And that is the interesting thing that I was thinking of. And my own father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease back in 1986 and passed away in 97. And they had just started talking about stem cell research and something that he thought was deplorable at the time. But that has changed so much. And in fact, you mentioned that you and your wife, Meredith Vieira, were invited to host and chair an adult stem cell conference at the Vatican. And science and the Vatican seem like sort of opposites. What changed? How did that affect you, that experience?
Well, first of all, the opposition of the Vatican was to embryonic stem cell treatments and therapies, and this was adult stem cells, and usually, or many times, it's your own stem cells. They called them autologous cells, and so the church had no opposition to that. As a matter of fact, they wanted to get out from under the controversy about embryonic cells, and so that's why they hosted the conference. And I must say that they take science very seriously. They do a lot of work there with no regard to race, religion, or nationality. They have all kinds of people coming in as guest lecturers or doing research, and is really very impressive.
What was it? There's a remark in one of the information pieces that I received is that something there had caught you off guard. What was that while you were at the Vatican?
I'm not sure.
Okay. How did your views on religion shift in this process?
Well, they didn't really shift because I'm really not a person of faith, but I have great respect for those who are. And part of writing the book was spending time with clergy from virtually every major religion and learning from them, trading ideas, disagreeing or agreeing. And it was a wonderful, productive process, and it didn't change my thinking, nor, by the way, did it change their thinking. But people can learn from each other even when they disagree.
Yeah, oh, that's for sure. We're talking with Richard M. Cohen. He is the author of Chasing Hope, A Patient's Deep Dive into Stem Cells, Faith, and the Future. And you were diagnosed at 25 and basically told at that point there's no hope, but you really seemed to defy the odds for a time. You lived adventurously. What was that moment like when you knew that part was over?
Well, it was really a reckoning that was a long time coming. I was very lucky. Look, I worked in the news business for decades. I traveled the world. I covered wars. I covered presidential politics. It was physically demanding, but I managed to do it. It wasn't always easy, and with failing eyesight, it was even more difficult. But I think part of hope is having a positive attitude and just going for it, you know, and feeling good about yourself and feeling comfortable with what's in front of you. And I never had any doubts about what I was doing. But it reached a point in the 1990s when I realized I just couldn't do it anymore. It was just too physically demanding. Mm-hmm. And I was not ever going to get into a situation where I let anybody down professionally. And I knew it was time to step away. And that's really when I started writing.
And when you first start the book, it talks, you have this opening that you're legally blind, but at that time you could still make out shadows, and you were on the bus, and then suddenly you can't see anything. That must have been terrifying.
It was. I've lost it. There's something called optic neuritis that people with MS get episodically, you know, suddenly get it for a while, and it affects your eyes. And I was on a very familiar bus ride down Broadway, and I sort of knew every building I was passing, and I used it, you know, I mean, they were landmarks, and it helped me to know when to get on and get off. And when I realized, as I'm looking out the window, that I couldn't see where I was and I didn't recognize buildings, it was like getting hit by lightning. I mean, it really was frightening. And I heard a bus driver talking to an older person, telling her where to get off, you know, and identifying the next stop. And that's literally how I figured out where I was. And I just counted the stops and got off. But I'm telling you, when I left that bus, I was a different person from what I was when I got on.
Yeah, yeah. I can only imagine. And your own father had MS as well. How did that affect your thinking of the disease and inform you with your own family?
Well, and his mother had MS too. I'm the third generation in a row. And my father practiced medicine for 40 years. And when I was diagnosed, we talked, and he didn't make much of it. Or when they suspected that's what I had, and he called me back, and he told me that he thought I did have it. And of course, he was correct. He was a great role model. He didn't. I never heard him complain. He was very strong. He did not feel sorry for himself, and those were very important lessons to learn. And I'm grateful to him for teaching them, because that's how I feel. You know, too many people see themselves as victims. I don't see myself as a victim. I think that you got to play the cards you're dealt. You got to fight. You've got to persevere, and you've got to want something badly enough that you just go for it. And that's how I felt about the news business.
Well, and obviously you certainly did, because you have a very distinguished career, winning multiple awards. And as the person that is not usually the topic of a subject that you're involved in, what was that like for you initially to open up your life and your family life to the world with your MS story?
Well, my first book, which was called Blindsided, that was really when I crossed the river. I mean, I always had been a private person, although I wrote a series of pieces for the New York Times when I had cancer. And I realized that when you write a book like Blindside, which is sort of a memoir, you've got to be honest. You've got to be open. You've got to tell the truth, even when it hurts. And I got used to it, and my family got used to it, and I was very careful with our kids mm-hmm. about what I said with regard to them. And I treated Meredith pretty gently because she deserved that. She's a pretty tough woman, mm-hmm. but and she's certainly been by my side through the whole thing. You know what? It felt fine if in the end. And you know, we decided early on to talk very openly to our kids. Kids are the smartest ones in the house. Yeah. They hear things, they see things. You know, their radar is always going. And if you want your kids to be safe and secure and strong, talk to them. Yeah. Don't keep secrets. And we did that, and they're adults now, and I think they're pretty well adjusted and ready to talk about anything like this because it's been part of our lives.
And they're all, do you have three children. Do they have MS? Does anyone?
No, nobody does.
Oh.
Nobody does. That's... And hopefully nobody will.
Right.
I'm told there are no, as I said, I'm the third generation. There's nothing in the literature about a fourth generation. So, okay. And they're already, all three are older than I was and my father was. So hopefully they're going to escape it.
Well, I have to say, Chasing Hope, this is obviously so well written. It's really a great read for anybody that is struggling with a chronic illness. There are parts of it that are funny, parts that are no holds barred, and a lot of information as well on stem cell research. And one of the questions are, what do you believe is the difference between hope and faith? And what does that mean for patients with illness?
Well, some people believe that you have to have faith to have hope. And I talk to members of the clergy who actually do believe that. And I myself do not think that the two are tied. You know, I think that hope is sort of organic. I think hope is just inside of us. And mm-hmm. it's there for everybody. And the challenge is to make it flourish. And living a positive life, feeling optimistic, feeling good about yourself and what you're doing is a form of hope. It's, you know, in and mm-hmm. of itself. And that's how I feel. And I don't need any religion to feel like I am hopeful. Mm-hmm. Look, there are 1,000 variations. There are different ways to look at it. That's just how I choose to see it.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense because it does come down to a personal decision. And when you had mentioned about you're not going to be a victim, really, once you do choose to call yourself a victim, you've pretty much lost the battle because as a victim, I guess I would think it's pretty hard to have hope.
No question about it. No question about it.
Yeah.
And when I see people like that, I just feel very bad for them because, look, nobody can look at my life and what I've done and my family and see it as a tragedy. It's not a tragedy.
Yeah.
I have a great life. I've had a great life. And I intend to keep having a great life. And no sickness that I have is going to stand in my way.
And I think that's the whole thing about Chasing Hope is that you're also offering that, giving people a glimpse as to what their life can be like with hope. So,
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
What is the biggest thing that you want people to get out of reading Chasing Hope?
Well, I think the biggest thing is to keep going. You know, the biggest thing, there is so much sickness in this country, and chronic illnesses, which are by definition incurable, are increasing because they correlate to age. We are becoming the oldest population in the history of the country. And I think I want people to see that there's more to their lives than perhaps they realize, and that there's more that they can achieve. And don't sit still. You know, I mean, don't wait for something to happen. Make something happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that I think we all have the power to do that in various ways. And I hope people take that idea seriously.
And you did indeed. Yeah.
Well, I think you have to.
And just one last question as we wrap up here. What has your therapy, your stem cell therapy, been like? And where do you see it going?
Well, I'm gonna keep going. I was in a what's called a phase one trial, which is basically to test the safety. I'm gonna be in a phase two trial, which is a larger trial, just to see if it's effective. And I'm very, very fortunate to have gotten into these trials. And I'm very hopeful. But I have to say at the same time, it's a privilege to be doing this. You know, it's a privilege to be a pioneer, you know, to go where others have not gone. I have no doubts about it. I have no fears. I'm just very, very grateful that I'm going to have this opportunity again.
And we are grateful that you've written Chasing Hope, A Patient's Deep Dive into Stem Cells, Faith, and the Future. Richard M. Cohen, thank you so much for your time, and we wish you the best.
Thank you so much.